And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guests are Kristen Olson and Kelly James Enger. First up is Kristen Olson. Kristen is a freelance writer who has published nonfiction articles and essays in the New York Times, Ms., Salon, Discover, Food and Wine, and Tin House. She's also published short fiction in Ascent, Indiana Review, Akros, and other literary magazines. She received her MFA from Bennington College and now lives in Cleveland, just miles from the Poor Clares, and Stalking the Divine, her new book by Hyperion Theoline, is about the Poor Clares of Cleveland. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Barbara.
You have written such a wonderful, impassioned book about a spiritual journey. And, gosh, it's literary. It's so revealing. Will you talk about how this book began?
Well, it's funny. I really never, ever set off to write a book about a spiritual quest because I didn't know that I would be on one. I kind of stumbled onto the Poor Clares one Christmas morning. I had been raised a Catholic, and I had, like so many people, bailed out back when I was in my teens and had been a very happily scornful atheist for years and years and years. But, you know, without my really realizing it, this sort of longing for faith had been welling up in me, and I had started sort of surreptitiously, not really talking a lot about it to my friends and my family, visiting different churches, and I just sort of stumbled upon the Poor Clares Church this Christmas morning, and I was so fascinated by them. I was drawn there by an ad in the paper that said that they were going to sing, and their name, the Poor Clares of Perpetual Adoration, I thought it sounded like a Saturday Night Live skit, and I was so intrigued by their name, and I went to the church, and I kept waiting for them to, you know, march in and sing, and they didn't come, and finally there was singing from behind this barricade in the front of the church, and I realized that they were cloistered, and I was just astounded by that, you know, didn't really realize that there was such a thing as cloistered nuns anymore, or at least not in this country.
Yeah. Now, the book is very much, a spiritual memoir, I suppose. And I'm curious how you chose the form, how it became this as opposed to, say, a book that might have been more removed, might have been a little more, more of a, removed, a story about them and not so much about you.
Well, I don't know. Its form just sort of grew. Even though I wrote the first chapter pretty much as it is, right from the beginning, and the first chapter does have a lot about me in there. I thought that I was writing a book about them. I thought it would be kind of cool to write a book like Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief. You know, I was really fascinated with books of nonfiction like that looked at some odd little subculture of people that led fascinating lives but were kind of beyond the radar of most people. I was interested in writing a book like that, and I thought that that was the kind of book that I was going to wind up writing, that it was going to be all about the Poor Clares and not about me. And then, you know, I have friends, of course, who read everything that I do, and they said, well, you know, this is kind of about you. And so it just kind of evolved that way. I didn't really plan it. It just happened.
Yeah. I love how you also write about the writing journey, you know, trying to make this book, and how, you know, there were some obstacles in your way, mostly put there by the Poor Clares.
Well, at first, yeah, they were very skeptical isn't even the right word. They, you know, when you're a freelance journalist or any sort of journalist, you're really not used to having elusive subjects. I mean, most people just love to talk about themselves, unless, you know, they're under indictment. but when I first approached them and said that I was interested in writing about them, Well, for one thing, they just never returned. I sent them a letter. I sent them a couple of letters, and they didn't respond for ages and ages. And I kept sort of persistently nibbling around the edges of their monastery, and finally they agreed to talk to me. But I really think that they lead a life that is so remote, so removed from the kind of life that most of us lead, that the whole business of having a book written about them just seemed so remote that they could hardly even notice it on the horizon. You know, it was just like yet another tiny noise from way in the distance.
That is so interesting.
It was interesting. It was, and then actually, when we finally got over the hump, we finally got to the point where they said, "Well, okay, we'll talk to you once a week. We'll take turns talking to you once a week," and then they started to actually meet with me in the blue parlor, which is their main visitor's parlor.
Yes.
Then they were really quite warm and open and really very, actually shockingly candid about their lives. I mean, some of them told me things that I would never have expected them to tell me. So they were really quite lovely to talk to.
Mm. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Kristen Olson, author of Stalking the Divine. And I need to say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest and not those of the University of California Regents. Did you know what you would find when you began? Did you know where this would lead you?
No, I didn't know where it would lead me. I mean, I hoped that they would have interesting stories to tell me, and they did. And I also had a hope that talking to them would help me find my way to faith. I figured that who should know more about faith than these women who, based on faith, left the world. And they all had interesting lives. They all had very full, very rich lives before they became poor Clares, before they became cloistered nuns. I was hoping that talking to them would help me find my way to some sort of accommodation with faith or some sort of place in faith. And so I was really nervous when I was writing the book because I kept thinking, wait, do I have it yet? Do I have it yet? Am I there? I'm not.
Will you read to us?
Pardon me?
Will you read to us?
Sure. I'm going to read a few pages just from the beginning.
Okay.
It was my fifth Christmas morning without my two children. Their father and I had agreed after our divorce that Jamie and Matthew would spend this holiday with him, a day always ribboned with loveliness and impossible yearnings and melancholy, but the latter had taken over. Without the children, I was desperate for joy, so desperate that I decided to go to church. As I unfolded the morning paper, I imagined the kids still sleeping, not wanting to wake up to the absence of their childhood and the ghosts of family Christmases past. Then I imagined them up and about, groggily partaking in some holiday routine that had developed without me, a new collection of small observances they'd no doubt accumulated during their last four Christmases. There would be no stockings to tug away from the hearth, no little feet scurrying to see what Santa might have left them. After all, they were both in their early 20s, and their father is Jewish and didn't go in as much for Christmas frippery as he did when the two of us were together. Still, I brooded over sentimental tableaus featuring the four of them, the kids, my ex-husband, and his then-fiancé, without me. Did they have a special breakfast together while listening to Bing Crosby sing White Christmas? Did they go for an early walk in the woods and hang up strings of popcorn for the chickadees? Did they put together a box of winter gloves for families at a homeless shelter? Had an altogether more festive and wholesome holiday regimen flowered in my absence? Or did the children bicker with their father and grumble about getting up before noon and snipe at his fiancé? I enjoyed that tableau the most. The children had spent Christmas Eve at my house, the house that still bears all the scars from their childhood, with my new husband, J.D., and me. We opened our presents and threw balled-up wrapping paper at the dog. My daughter and I played the soundtrack to Footloose over and over again and danced around the dining room table while my husband and son watched an old movie. Now, my husband and I were alone in the bleakness of Christmas morning. My children had left at around midnight, and my husband's teenage boys wouldn't arrive from Florida until the next day. Even though we'd been adopted by friends for Christmas dinner those last few years, there were still many long dead hours to endure before the holiday lights would start to shine again in our house. As I paged idly through the newspaper looking for after Christmas sales, I stumbled upon a section about local religious activities, including a full page of boxed ads for Christmas services. "Have churches always advertised?" I said out loud, but only the dog was in the room to hear me, and she just sighed.
Thank you so much. That was Kristen Olson reading from Stalking the Divine. What a wonderful beginning to this book. I was curious if this was the original beginning.
It was the original beginning. I think it has the tone of, I didn't really write it that, I didn't say, oh, here's the tone I want and write it that mindfully, but it does capture the tone that I think works for the kind of audience that I was trying to reach, which were other people like me, other people who had, for one reason or another, become estranged from faith and had developed a longing for it and just weren't sure how to make that connection again, didn't know how to go about it, and felt embarrassed of it. I felt embarrassed, frankly, around all my scornful atheist friends and my, circle who, even if there were some people in there who dared to have any sort of faith, they certainly didn't talk about it, and they certainly didn't write about it. So I wanted that tone in there, a tone that was sort of, that showed my skittishness about faith.
Yeah. And also the book is quite literary, so that it isn't, it would be, differentiated from, say, Christian literature, because it's very, it has that, all those questions all over. It has literary writing. It has all kinds of things going for it that I think put it into a whole other category.
Well, one of the things I really did try to keep in mind when I was writing it is that I did kind of, I don't read those books about, for the most part, I don't read most of those books about spirituality and Christian life. And when I have tried to, I've just found many of them frightfully dull. And I really did try to write this almost as if it were a novel, where I made the nuns themselves come alive. I do write fiction, so I tried to make the nuns themselves come alive as characters using a lot of the tricks that I would use if I were writing a novel. And, at first I was, here I am. I go once a week and I talk to these women. What kind of a plot is that? And it was funny because a friend of mine was telling a friend of his about my book and saying, well, what's she going to do? She just goes and talks to these nuns every week. And the friend thought about it, and then he said, someone must die, as if it was going to turn into a murder mystery. But then it's generally the case that even when it doesn't seem like there's conflict and tension in a situation, there usually is one, of one kind or another. And really, there in this period of time, there was a lot of tension. One of the things that I was so aware of was that this was a group of women who had selected a way of life. Most of them selected it 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they were declining in numbers and aging, and it was very unclear to me whether how much longer they could continue to survive as a group and do what they did. They needed a certain number of women to be able to continue their 24-hour cycle of prayers. And so that was one source of tension in the book was, are they going to be able to make it? Are they going to be able to hang on? Will anybody new join them? Are they going to be able to have the strength to keep doing this? And then, of course, the other tension just in terms of the me part of the book was, would I find faith? Would this make any difference, this whole experience of talking to these highly spiritual women for a couple of years?
I quite found it a page-turner, actually, because, as you said, there was their story and there was your story, and it wasn't clear what was going to happen.
Good.
Curious also, then, in terms of selling this book, how was that? Was it easy? I don't know if you already had an agent or if you found an agent with this project and how it was then to find Hyperion, which is just such an excellent publisher.
It was actually kind of, well, it was pretty quick and easy selling it. I didn't have an agent. I had worked with an agent, a different agent, maybe 10 years ago, who was trying to sell a novel that I had written. And this time, I finished the book. A friend of mine read it, and he liked it so much, he sent it to his agent, who turned it down because it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't for her. And but was kind enough to talk to me about what, you know, some of her, you know, questions were, and then to refer somebody else. So I sent it to the person that she referred, and that person also turned it down but referred to other agents, and I sent it to those two. And I kind of went through about a series of five things like that where somebody turned it down but said, but I really love it, try this person. And then I finally wound up with the agent that I have, and well, she kind of misplaced it for a while. That was the only thing that took a while.
What do you mean?
Then when we, you know, got back on track, and she read it in a couple of days, and, you know, she told me she loved it. She had some ideas for selling it, and she sold it in a week.
Interesting. So she misplaced it, meaning it was just somewhere in her office. And she
right.
Just, okay, at first I thought you meant that she was trying to sell it as a different kind of book.
No.
Okay. So then she sold it in a week.
Yeah.
I love it when things happen like that.
Well, I do too.
So now that it's out, how I know you're active in various organizations and such, but how have you found the marketing aspect? I mean, is that something that's easy for you, or you know, how do you deal with that?
It's easier than I thought it would be. That's the kind of thing that I really had dreaded, and it's the kind of thing a lot of writers dread. And it's certainly the part of my freelance life that I find so difficult is, you know, selling ideas to editors and talking people into letting me write for them. So that it's a challenge in that part of my life. I mean, one of the things that's happened a lot is so maybe this makes it a little less scary, is that I have done a lot of internet marketing, you know, just sending emails off to people that I think, people or organizations that I think are going to be interested. The thing that's really surprised me, or one of the things, I mean, there have been so many surprising things that have happened after the book came out, but one of the things that surprised me is I was so terrified when it first came out and it was time for my first public reading. I mean, I really hadn't done a lot of that kind of thing. And I realized after the night was over, and there was a huge crowd that came, I realized after the night was over that I had really enjoyed myself. And things have continued that way. I've done a lot of readings. I've started speaking to a lot of groups. I've started meeting with a lot of book clubs. And it's something that, to my great astonishment, I've found that I really like doing.
Interesting.
So I never expected that.
Yeah. And I have to say that a friend heard about you and your book on Readerville.com and bought a couple of copies for lapsed Catholic friends of hers. And when she received my email notice about you being on the show, she said, that's the one on Readerville.com.
Oh, how funny.
So you're out there.
Yeah. You know, another thing that really shocked me after the book came out was that I had expected that people who were in my category, you know, or at least who I was when I started writing the book, you know, this non-believer longing for belief, I had expected those people to be interested in the book and like the book. But what surprised me, I was sort of afraid of, you know, people who were of strong faith and had never strayed, and who were, you know, heavily involved in their church or their synagogue or their mosque, you know, people who were really, and it's been so interesting to me that I hear from those people too, that even people who are of really strong faith, still, I think, if they're, they also see themselves as being seekers, even though they seem from the outside to be far more settled and, you know, not dogmatic, but, you know, settled and comfortable within a certain religious tradition. I had one woman call me who's the pastoral minister for a huge Catholic church here in Cleveland, and she said she read my book and she just loved it, and she felt like it was speaking to her heart and all this stuff, and she wanted me to come and talk to a group. And I said, you? I never thought that you would like this book or that you would feel that it spoke to you. And she said, oh, no. She said, I'm much more comfortable with people who have doubts than with people who have no doubts.
Interesting.
So that's been something that's really been just fascinating for me.
Sure.
and a real eye-opener.
Hmm. Oh, well, you've written a wonderful book, and it's also beautiful to look at, actually. It's such a nice cover and presentation, which always means a lot.
Yeah.
Do you have any last words or advice for the writers who are listening?
Oh, gee. Well, I think that probably it's the same advice that everybody always gives everybody, is just that you have to write whatever you become passionate about. I mean, I have a friend who I told him I was writing this book about me and these nuns and faith and all that, and he said, I don't know, why would you waste your time writing a book about a bunch of old women who don't have sex? And, but he was wrong. He was wrong because it was something that had, that their story had some passion for me and
sure.
great interest for me, and I was confident that it would for other people,
yeah.
too.
And it sure does.
Well, thank you.
And I so appreciate you coming on. And talking about your book.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me.
That was Kristen Olson speaking to us from Cleveland, Ohio. Her book, again, is Stalking the Divine, published by Hyperion the Theoline. And when we return from the break, I'll have Kelly James Anger with us. So please stay tuned. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my next guest is Kelly James Anger. After 5.5 years as an attorney, Kelly left law and changed her career to writing. She's now a full-time freelance journalist and author and professional speaker. In addition to her books, Kelly's work has appeared in more than 40 magazines, including Marie Claire, Redbook, and Oxygen. She's author of the nonfiction writing book, Ready, Aim, Specialize, Create Your Own Writing Specialty and Make Money, published by The Writer Books. And she's author of the novel, Did You Get the Vibe?, published this year by Kensington. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on the show. You have written such a fun book, and I know a little bit about the genesis, but our listeners don't. So I wonder if you would talk about how this book came about. You were a, extremely successful journalist, and here's fiction.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I took a kind of a long or a roundabout way to it. I majored in fiction writing in college. That's what
I
majored in. And went to law school so that I would have a quote-unquote career and be able to support myself. And when I quit my job as an attorney to freelance full-time, I started a novel and was going to write for magazines to pay the bills. And what happened was my magazine career took off, and that novel, which featured an unhappy female lawyer, got shelved. Then the next year I started novel number two, also featuring unhappy female lawyer number two, and that got shelved, and I went through a couple more false starts before I actually sat down and wrote this novel. And I think what made the difference was there is an unhappy female lawyer in it, but her best friend, I wanted to write a novel about female friendship because I think in your 20s, your girlfriends are usually more important than the men in your life.
Yeah.
So, and I think the other reason I started with fiction was I have been fairly successful in my writing career, but what I did in terms of taking something I love to do, which is write, and turn it into a career where you're always focused on making more money, and the bottom line is I leached a lot of creativity right out of it. And writing fiction, again, was a way to rediscover that and write because I wanted to write for myself, not because I have to write about five reasons to eat more fiber for a nutrition magazine. That's actually a story I've done. So.
Well, so then the book itself, did you write it knowing perhaps what genre you were going to write it for, or did you just start writing it because it was fun to write?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I started the book was right at the beginning of the chick lit movement, not the gum, but chick, like, you know, C-H-I-C-K, lit, short for literature, which started in this country. It came over from the UK, and it started with Bridget Jones' Diary and books like Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing,
yes.
Good in Bed, In Her Shoes. Now we're seeing things like Mommy Lit, I Don't Know How She Does It, Alison Pearson's book, Devil Wears Prada is another chick lit example. But at the time I finished it, Red Dress, Inc., which is an imprint of Harlequin, had just started here in the States, and they were looking for books like this. Books that feature urban single women in their 20s and 30s, usually struggling with their careers, with men, with their families, with their friends, with their self-identity. And I didn't intend to write a chick lit novel, but that's what it ended up being. So it was one of those things where when I finished, I realized, oh, I wrote this kind of genre novel without intending to.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a fun book, but there's also sort of this streak of, I don't know what to call it. I don't want to say exactly darkness, but trouble with this eating disorder going on. How did that find its way into it?
Well, and you know what's funny is I was bulimic in college and through, I'd say, my mid-20s off and on. And I didn't know that the Tracy character in the book was bulimic. And I really didn't know until she started puking up her Cheetos. And I realized that's what Tracy is. You kind of have a clue when you start the book that she has some issues with her body, and then it all made sense. Then I got her, and sometimes I think when you're writing fiction, you don't really know the characters, and then they start acting on their own. I was like, oh, that's what it is. And actually, when I started writing that, I was talking to my husband one night, and I was sitting there saying, you know, I'm really worried about Tracy. She's got a lot of issues, and she's not really happy with Tom, and she's got, you know, this eating disorder. And he says, who are you talking about? And I said, oh, my character. And, you know, she was a real person to me. But I wanted to, so many of these books, and of course we live in a whole culture where women are supposed to look a certain way and supposed to be a certain size or whatever, but so many of these books focus solely on the dieting, and I wish my thighs were thinner. And there can be a real backlash with that. I didn't know she was bulimic until, you know, I discovered she was, and then I thought, this is really important because she's really struggling with this eating disorder, which can be fatal, which is what killed Karen Carpenter, for example, and yet her best friend loses weight and becomes more attractive, more desirable, more, you know, sexually interesting to all the men around her because she's now, quote-unquote, looks, you know, better than she did or has the perfect body now. So I wanted those two stories to kind of contrast each other.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Kelly James Enger, author of Did You Get the Vibe?, published by Kensington Books. And I need to say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. So it sounds like the characters came first.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And then the situation sort of found its way through the characters?
Exactly. And I knew, the only thing I knew is that I wanted to write about a woman who has a career that everyone tells her is wonderful, who's unhappy in it. I, strangely enough, was an unhappy female lawyer. But when you put a lot of time and effort into your career, you spend years going to school, you spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, and then you get into this place that you find you don't really enjoy, and yet you've invested a huge amount of time and effort and energy, and it's really difficult for people to just walk away. I think especially in the legal profession, there are a lot of unhappy lawyers who stay in because they kind of have to stay in. And so I knew that she was going to struggle with getting out of the law, but I didn't know how, and I didn't know what she was going to do. And I knew that Tracy was going to have this issue with, is she with the right guy or not? But that's really all I knew, and it kind of took off from there.
Uh-huh. Well, will you read to us?
Sure.
Okay.
This is chapter one, So Have You Ever Googled Anyone? Broken-hearted women are supposed to lose weight, so why was she getting so fat? Kate frowned at her reflection in the full-length mirror that hung inside the door of her closet. She'd already given up on her hair. It was only early April, but the humidity of the Chicago spring made maintaining any reasonable hairstyle for any length of time impossible. It looked decent now, but a few minutes outside and it would flatten like soggy roadkill. She'd opted for minimal makeup, mascara, blush, a nice pink lipstick, dangly silver earrings, nude hose, and her favorite black salmon Libbies. Her head and feet were ready. The problem was what to do with what stretched between the two. She'd already considered and rejected four different outfits, all of which were lying crumpled on the bed where she'd tossed them. She had nothing to wear. She had suits and she had jeans and very little in between. Her closet was filled with tasteful, conservative, read, boring suits and traditional long-sleeve blouses for work and an assortment of T-shirts, baggy sweaters, and khakis, most of which dated back to law school, if not college, for weekend wear. She had clothes for work and clothes for hanging out, but not many outfits appropriate for a cocktail party, especially not in Lakeview. The reason, the only reason she was going was because Tracy had begged her, "Please, Kate, I promise there'll be some hotties here. You'll have a good time," Tracy had said on the phone just 30 minutes ago when Kate had called with a pathetic last-minute excuse. Then she lowered her voice. "Come on, you cannot leave me here with Tom and all his lawyer friends." "Thanks a lot. You're talking to one, remember?" Kate checked her face in the bathroom mirror. There was definitely the start of a new wrinkle between her eyebrows. "You know what I mean. You just happen to be a lawyer. The guys from the firm all fit the profile." "Uh-huh. And what about the hotties? Do they fit the profile, too?" Obviously, Tracy had already forgotten about her bribe, but she recovered smoothly. "Oh, yeah. What's his name? Bob, I think. He's a new associate at Tom's firm. He's cute. He's nice. He's single." When Kate didn't answer, Tracy changed tactics. "Look, you've got to get out of the house. Happening women do not stay at home on Saturday nights watching the Discovery Channel, especially when they live in Lakeview, the hippest, most happening Chi-Town neighborhood, save Lincoln Park. They're out seeking adventure, new experiences, new thrills, new men. Give me a break. So I like Raging Planet. That's what I need, you know, a guy who will stay home and watch natural disasters with me instead of his whole getting dressed and going out thing." "Yeah, well, you have to go out first to find someone to stay in with, remember? There's no shortage of guys around, Kate. You just have to get out there. Remember, honey, we live in the same neighborhood, and haven't you noticed that a lot of these great guys also happen to be gay? But not all of them." Tracy was relentless. Kate knew when she was beat. All right. I'll be over there in a while." "Okay, sweetie, I promise you'll have fun. Just show up." I'll stop there. That's good philosophy, too. Just show up. Woody Allen, 80% of success is showing up.
That's right. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and that was Kelly James Enger reading from Did You Get the Vibe? That's so true, and you've actually made that a reality because you've just, you know, I guess in 97 you turned to freelancing.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And kind of became successful, it seems, really fast.
You know, I think that's true. I've been doing this full-time for 7 years now, and I just had coffee with a guy yesterday whose dream is to freelance full-time, and it's really funny when you're looking back on the beginning of your career. It's probably like labor pains where you forget how bad it was, mm-hmm. You know, once you have the career or the baby you want. And the first year and a half, I really worked insanely. I mean, I worked 50, 60 hours a week. I sent out hundreds of queries. I, at one time, had 54 queries out there. I was relentless. And it did take me a couple years to really get my feet under me. But once that happened, things have been relatively easy since then. But part of that is because I focus on developing relationships with editors, not just doing one-shot stories. I'm a fast writer, I'm a fairly fast researcher, and I've always run my writing business like a business. And in fact, that's why I started writing fiction again, because when you're doing it, you know, thinking how much am I getting a word, how much am I getting an hour, how many times can I reprint this, you know, when you're thinking about that constantly, you're not necessarily trying to write the best article you can write. You're trying to write the fastest, decent article you can write.
So talk about that, the differences between fiction and nonfiction. I mean, there's, as you said, you know, one is more focused on, say, your income,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously nonfiction.
Right.
So then fiction.
Now, the fiction isn't paying so well so far. You know, when I talk about this with students or when I speak, I say that I think the big difference is usually people read nonfiction to learn something. So when you're writing nonfiction, you are trying to communicate information in such a way that people will, you know, read your article or read your book and learn something, broaden their knowledge of a particular subject. I'm not saying that all nonfiction is service journalism, but most nonfiction serves a purpose to educate or to inform. Fiction, we read fiction to escape. We read fiction to basically step into someone else's life. And when you're writing fiction, that means that you have a lot more latitude, But it also, I think, is harder to control because of that, because you want to give the reader this experience of stepping into someone else's life. But if you're at all self-critical, like every writer is, then you write a sentence and you think, oh, this is awful. This doesn't exactly communicate the emotion I'm trying to communicate, where I think nonfiction is easier. I really do.
Hmm. So how do you manage your time between fiction and nonfiction?
When I'm writing the first draft of a novel, I work on it every day just to keep the continuity going. Now, I'm actually taking a break from fiction right now because I have a big book project that's kind of eating up all my mental time. But normally I make time, maybe usually about an hour a day, not a major time commitment, but some time to work on it. But the lion's share of my day is spent doing nonfiction. I write my fiction drafts on an AlphaSmart, which is a portable word processor, because that lets me get out of my office. I hate being in my office when I don't have to be here, and that makes me portable. Then when I actually go to edit the second draft and have to work at my desk, I have a little trick, and I actually wear a hat when I edit fiction. When I have the hat on, that's all I do. I don't check my email. I don't come up with query ideas. I don't work on anything nonfiction, and that's kind of my physical trigger that I'm supposed to be working on fiction. It's been effective, actually.
That's interesting. How'd you come up with that?
Yeah. I saw a wonderful speaker, Judy Reeves.
Uh-huh.
Do you know who she is?
Yes.
She's an author of Writer's Book of Days. And,
yeah. She's
a couple
in San
years
Diego.
Ago, she presented at the San Diego State Writers Conference in January, and she was talking about the importance of making your writing space sacred. And she's kind of a more touchy-feely speaker and writer than I am by nature. But I thought she made a point about, whether it's lighting a candle or having flowers or making the space very comfortable and important to you. And I thought, well, I can't do that. The place where I create fiction is also the place where I have to work and pay my bills and do everything else in my office. And I thought, what I need is some kind of external trigger to remind myself that this is different, this is it. And I realized what I needed was a hat. And again, that harkens back to my college days when I had what I called my Kurt Vonnegut hat, and I would wear my hat when I was writing fiction and, of course, smoke a lot of cigarettes and give my roommates dirty looks when they tried to bother me to do anything. So I actually have a picture somewhere of this Kurt Vonnegut hat. I have lost it since then. So I decided that I would pick a dorky hat. I have a lot of weird hats, and so now I have one that I use just for fiction.
So when it's on, you just don't do anything else?
I don't, and even if my husband comes up to ask me a question, I will either point at the hat and not answer, or I will actually take it off. So I use the same kind of strategy when I studied for the bar. I had a chair that I sat in the law library, and when I sat down, I studied. I didn't do the crossword. I didn't talk to anybody. And if one of my friends came up and believe me, the last 2 months before the bar is stressful. Oh, my God, I don't understand promissory estoppel. Can you explain it? I would actually get up, walk away from my chair, and after 2 or 3 weeks, the act of sitting in that chair to study, it was easier to concentrate because it was, my mind's like, oh, okay, we're going to study for the bar now. And it really made a difference. I'm sort of superstitious.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I think rituals, it's sort of a ritual, and I think it works.
They
work.
And I think Susan Perry, in her book Writing and Flow, interviewed dozens of writers. And I think most of us have rituals, and even if it's something you're not conscious of, for example, I get up in the morning, and usually the first thing I do every morning is check my email. That's not really a ritual, but it is because it's probably waking up my subconscious getting ready to write without me really consciously thinking about it.
Yeah, interesting stuff. We have a few minutes left with Kelly James Anger, author of Did You Get the Vibe, published by Kensington, and Ready, Aim, Specialize, Create Your Own Writing Specialty and Make More Money, published by The Writer Books. Did you worry at all with Did You Get the Vibe about readers, especially readers identifying you with Kate, because Kate's a lawyer and you were a lawyer and all of that? Did you worry about that? Or?
It's funny because Kate is a lot of me is Kate. But what really cracked me up was, for example, my roommate from law school read it and she thought she knew all the guys in the book, and all the guys in the book are fiction. one guy in particular, the old boyfriend who comes back into her life, is very, very, very loosely based on an old boyfriend of mine. But I, you know, you take bits and pieces of people that you know for the other characters. So, yeah, sure, there's some of me in Kate. I'm a runner. I was an unhappy lawyer. There's some of me, but not all of me. My biggest fear was in this book, the parents, the families of the two main characters don't really play a role. And in my second novel that's coming out this November, it's much more about a woman's relationship with her family, not just with her friends and her boyfriends. And in the novel before this one that I had started and didn't finish, I had made the main character's mother a smoker who was prone to doing things, you know, sitting at the kitchen table with a big cup of black coffee and a cigarette and taking a deep drag and saying things like, well, people in hell want ice water, when her daughter complains about how unfair life is. And my mom found out and was furious with me because I had made her a smoker. So as long as you're not, you know, I'm less concerned with someone thinking a character is me than someone thinking, you know, a character that I've portrayed maybe not in a flattering light is someone else. Also, since I am a lawyer, I've been really, really careful about not libeling anyone. So I'm always aware of that, too.
Mm-hmm. What about the process of actually getting the novel published? How did that go for you?
You know, and this is good advice for anyone out there who's working on a novel that they want to sell. The common belief is that you can't sell a novel to a big publisher without an agent. And I sent the book myself to Red Dress, Inc. And while Red Dress had it, I mentioned to my agent, who does mostly nonfiction, that I had finished this novel, and she asked to read it. And she called me a couple weeks later and said, you know, I really like this. It's really fun. She said, I think it will sell, but I don't know enough about this market to sell it. And she said, but I know John Scoglimilio at Kensington does this kind of book. I mean, this is literally what happened. And in the meantime, Red Dress passed on it. And as soon as they did, I sent a letter to John. And I didn't say, you know, my agent loves it, but doesn't think she, you know, you never want to start with something like that. I just sent him a query letter as an author looking for a publisher for my book. I mailed it on Saturday. On Tuesday, he emailed me and asked for the complete manuscript, and he bought it 3 weeks later. So it was, I really believe, and then when he bought it, I said, oh, well, I'll have my agent call you, but I sold it on my own. So it goes to show you that if you have the right publisher and you have the right editor and you have a good book, you can sell it on your own. I just spoke at a library the other night, and I told people that, because if I would have thought, oh, I can't pitch this to him as an individual, you know, then I would have had to go through getting an agent and then, you know, going through the pitch process that way.
Yeah.
I probably could have gotten more money had an agent. But, you know, with your first novel, you just want to sell the damn thing. So.
Sure. And also probably what's important here, too, is that you wrote a book that you wanted to write.
Correct.
Rather than thinking what would sell, what's
exactly.
Trendy, what's this, what's that, because you were right at the beginning of the chick lit.
Right. And, you know, I have to say there is a lot of it out now, and my next novel is also chick lit. I think it is being overpublished. I think it's going to be way overpublished. And what's going to happen is I think some public, you know, we're seeing tons of it now, and I think in another year or so it'll slow down. And I would much rather write a book that, if I'm writing fiction, I'm writing it for fun and because I want to. I never want to get to the point with my fiction writing that it becomes another have to. That's why I'm not working on a novel now, because I don't feel like it, and it shouldn't be something that I force myself to do. The best part about it for me has been, even when I wrote the second book, which I consciously wrote as chick lit, I was still excited to do it. And that's, you know, if you write all day long already and then you're going to write more, it needs to be something, you know, you're enjoying, not something that you're thinking, what am I going to make from this bottom line?
Yes.
Not that I don't want the books to be bestsellers. Of
sure.
Course, that would be wonderful. But I think you need to divorce your expectations and write what you want to write.
Yeah. Will you, or do you have any sort of last words or words of advice for the writers listening who may be struggling through a novel?
You know, I think, and I just said this the other night when I spoke at this library program, I think it really helps, especially when you're writing your initial draft, to write every day, even if you're only writing one scene a day, even if it's just a few paragraphs, it keeps your, I always get unconscious and subconscious mixed up. I think it's subconscious. It keeps your subconscious engaged in the story so that even when you're not thinking about it, the knowledge that you're going to work on it sometime that day keeps the story alive. And you'll find that the characters do take on lives of their own. Like a year and a half ago when I was working on Vibe, I had surgery, and I got up that morning and I brushed my teeth. You know, you can't drink any water or do anything. I brushed my teeth and I wrote a paragraph just because I knew I was going to be out of it all day and not be able to write anything else. And that was just, it's a sign to yourself, this is important to me, I'm committed to this work. And even if, you know, the old saying, even if you write a page a day, at the end of the year, you'll have a 365-page novel.
Yes.
Now, it may, you know, I don't want to say it'll suck, but it may need a lot of work. But Robert B. Parker, who writes the Spencer book, says, I can't edit a blank page.
Right.
You need to have something finished so that you can edit it and make it better. But just sitting around at Starbucks talking about how you want to write a novel, that's, you know, when I say, do you want to write a novel, I say there's a difference between wanting to write a novel and wanting to have written a novel. You know, most people want the second, but you have to do the first to get to the second.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Kelly.
Oh, thank you.
For coming on.
It's been fun.
And before you go, I want you to give your website.
Oh, sure. Thanks for asking. I've got information about my books on there. And for writers who are interested in nonfiction freelancing, I have lots of articles and a newsletter for writers, all that good stuff. It's www.kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, James, like Jesse James, J-A-M-E-S, E-N-G-E-R. There's a hyphen in my last name, but not on the website, .com. And if you just Google did you get the vibe as a phrase, or Kelly James Anger, my website comes up pretty quickly.
Excellent. Thank you so much, and gosh, continued good luck, great
Thank
luck
you.
with your fiction, as well as your nonfiction, but you don't need luck for that at all.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Kelly James Anger, and again, she's author of Did You Get the Vibe, published by Kensington Strapless. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to writersonwriting.com. There you can email me if you'd like to be on the weekly email list for the show. And I want to leave you with a quote by Francois Sagan, who said, "For nothing will alter my conviction that only by pursuing the extremes in one's nature, with all its contradictions, appetites, aversions, rages, can one hope to understand a little of what life is about." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and until next week.